The idea of fermented foods is not one embraced instantly by everyone, but you know, many of us like pickles, and fermented beverages are certainly popular. Today's guests are big on fermented vegetables. In fact, they wrote a book by that very title, Fermented Vegetables, and they call themselves fermentistas. That implies perhaps a greater dedication to fermentation than the average person. From fermentista.us, please welcome Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke. Good to have you both here today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
They live on 40 acres in the Applegate Valley. They host classes and workshops on what they do. So there's enough gray hairs that you guys have clearly been at this for a while. Did you become fermentistas together?
We did, actually. It started about 20 years ago when Kirsten got a bubbling crock as a Christmas present. And that started us on our path. But Kirsten's the brains of the operation. I'm more of the cleanup, jarring, process work.
Okay, you're the guy who makes sure that everything is going to operate as it's supposed to. You're the operations guy.
I'm the operations guy, and she's R&D. Yeah.
So when you started to say bubbling crock, I thought this is going to sound like an accidental story. Like we had a bubbling crock one day, but this is a nice gift. So I mean, who gave it to you, and what was your initial knowledge of what it was for?
My mom gave it to us. It was an antique crock, and she'd already started a batch, so it had the odor and everything of an active ferment. It was under the tree with a cookbook, and the kids were all a little concerned. So, yeah, and we really just made plain sauerkraut for years. It was when, with the farm, we were trying to find a way to create a value-added product that we started experimenting with. First, just putting different herbs or other vegetables in with a cabbage batch, but then it became sort of a almost a game to figure out, oh, do parsnips ferment? Do pumpkins ferment? And at the time, there wasn't a lot on the internet where there is now. And usually if I couldn't find anything that said it'd kill us, we went for it.
All right, before we get into some of the specifics of fermentation, let's go a little broad first. And I mean, you guys live on this 40-acre farm. You've had to have day jobs as well, I understand. But over time, you've been trying to keep a fairly natural, from the sounds of it, lifestyle.
Yeah, I think we're on a hillside, and we definitely have really tried to do the homesteading thing. We've done dairy animals and cheeses and cider and apples and all different things. And yeah, we've homeschooled our kids, so it's been pretty farm-based lifestyle.
So even before the fermentation stuff came around, you were looking for ways to have healthy, natural, whole foods.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've been doing that before it was even popular.
Are there ever any boxes of processed foods in your house?
Not really.
Well, so when you raise kids like this, the way to get back at them is to bring Cheetos back to the house. When the kids were going to SOU and other colleges, you know, when they'd come back, they would bring goodies for the
tater tots.
Tater tots. Oh, really? You know, that kind of thing. So.
And you tried to keep a lid on things and not say, what is this doing in my house? That sort of thing.
Yeah, when you haven't eaten an Oreo in 20 years, it tastes pretty good, the first bag.
So. It's the first bag. I never saw the equation expressed so perfectly as it is expressed at fermentista.us. Vegetables plus salt plus time equals yum. Is it really that simple a process, Kirsten?
It really is. It's really time, vegetables, salt, and the microbes that do all the work are inherently on the vegetable. And so that's what does the work. And you don't need to sterilize or anything. You want to have a clean process, but it doesn't need to be like canning where it's a super sterile environment. And then the biggest thing I can tell anybody ever is keeping everything under the brine, and you're keeping it anaerobic.
Keep it all submerged, basically.
Keep it all submerged.
Okay. So I noticed there's a fair number of weights and hold downs and things to make sure that everything stays down below the surface of the liquid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of people are coming up with creative, as fermentation is growing in interest, there are also a lot of people out there coming up with really creative ways to do just that. But ultimately, you don't need really anything more than a jar and even another little jar on top. And you just keep pressing that down and making sure that the carbon dioxide escapes and the brine stays down in your ferment.
Okay, we'll get more to the specifics in just a few minutes, but obviously you've made getting in easy. And, you know, again, with the equation, vegetables plus salt plus time equals yum. Is there, though, a yuck factor for many people when you first start saying fermented foods? Is there this sense of like, oh, my God, you know, it rose from the swamp, that sort of thing?
We've gotten a lot of stories. When we used to do the farmer's market in Ashland and Medford, sometimes people would come up and we had a really colorful booth, and so they didn't know what they were getting into. And once they crossed that threshold and then they were too close to leave, and then when they found out it was sauerkraut, some people are not bashful about telling you their favorite yuck sauerkraut story. But, you know, growing up, you remember canned sauerkraut in school. There's a lot of reasons to have those stories early on. So what we had to do is just get them past that, to say, yep, ban the can. It's horrible. It should have never been there. Try this. It's something different. And once you could get them to taste it, then you had a new conversation.
The canned sauerkraut is just like any canned vegetable, really just soggy.
It's dead.
Yeah, it's gross.
It's only the same in name, but compared to the fresh raw, it's not the same food at all.
Yeah.
All right, much more to talk about in the realm of fermented foods. The book is called Fermented Vegetables, Creative Recipes for Fermenting 64 Vegetables and Herbs in Krauts, Kimchi, Brined Pickles, Chutneys, Relishes, and Pastes. It's a very long subtitle. Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke from the Applegate Valley wrote it. They are our guests. They are fermentistas, and you can join them on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about fermented vegetables, the concept and the book by the same title. That's the title chosen for the book. Well, Fermented Vegetables. Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke, farmers from the Applegate Valley, our guests, and they call themselves fermentistas. Their website is fermentista.us. Whether you're a fermentista in training, a fully confirmed one, or one thinking about joining the ranks, feel free to join us as we discuss fermentation and how to get great things from fermenting vegetables. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Check us out on Facebook. Again, you see the picture of Kirsten and Christopher from just a few minutes ago before they sat down to get to work here in the studio. Seriously, there's a point in the book where you point out that your kids asked you why you couldn't get into chocolate making or something?
Especially.
Really? You said cheeses and things. You've done some dairy stuff. So, I mean, there's been a lot of different experiments, it sounds like, out at your farm.
Yeah, there has been. We actually built the commercial kitchen in order to do hard cider because we have grafted and planted a lot of heirloom apple trees. And while the trees were growing, we thought, let's do something simple. Fermenting vegetables is so safe. It's in the state of Oregon, at least, easy to get certified kitchen to do that, whereas the cheese laws are so much more stringent. And also, just having enough manpower to do the milking and all that as the with the dairy animals, and we knew we didn't want enough dairy animals to keep a business afloat.
We've talked about some of the regulations, particularly for things like raw milk and goat milk, and yeah, we've had a couple of farmers in here explain how tricky that was just to get that part of the process going. But you're saying that fermentation is that safe? Because that was one of the obvious questions: is like, can you actually kill yourself doing this?
No, and that's really the beauty of it. You know, a lot of the people out there talking about fermentation love to say nobody has died from fermented vegetables because it is so safe. Botulism and all the bad guys you hear about, E. coli, they can't live in the process when the process has been done right. And then the great thing is when the process is done wrong, it's disgusting. It's bad.
So you wouldn't want to eat it anyway.
No, it's not going to get near your mouth.
I noticed that warning in the book about if it does look slimy or smell bad. But okay, let's address the smell part first, because the last jar of kimchi I had in the house, Nobody wanted to come near because of the smell. It tasted great, and I could certainly understand where the people who were using only their noses were coming from. But there is going to be that odor aversion on some people's parts, isn't there?
There is. In fact, our first signing was at Powell's, and for the people that came by the Pearl Room not expecting to smell what they smelled, we lit up Powell's with seven different varieties of odor. Hopefully it doesn't still smell there. But there is, and it's great. Kirsten's got a funny story in the book where we built a certified kitchen on the farmhouse, and upstairs her parents and her father-in-law came down one morning looking for the gas leak. And he was convinced, he knew he smelled gas, we needed to get out of the house. And Kirsten kept saying, we don't have gas out here. And he's like, no, but I smell it. And we had just done our first batch of kimchi. And unfortunately, the fermenting kitchen is right below their bedroom. So they woke up to kimchi aroma. But yeah, it's part of the process. And when you love it, you love it. So,
how extensive is the ventilation system in your kitchen?
You know, we do have a few fans, but apparently for him that day, it was not enough.
Let's take a call. We have Bill and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about fermenting vegetables with Kirsten Shockey and Christopher Shockey.
Hi there. I'd like to check on some information I was giving, and correct me if I'm wrong. I'd really like to know if it's right. I was told you can take any fruit juice and get all the benefits of fermenting by adding more bacteria into your stomach, which you need, and also eliminate the sugars, which you really don't need, by just basically putting the fruit juice in, like, say, a half-gallon mason jar with a lid with a cloth or cheesecloth or even clean toilet paper, just let air breathe, and let it sit 3 to 4 days. And it'll let the bacteria grow healthy, and maybe, and I'm curious if it does produce any alcohol, but from the impression it'll make a little alcohol from the sugar, and I'm wondering how much alcohol it would make.
So is this regular fruit juice left open to the air?
Any fruit juice. Just let it sit out 3 to 4 days, and it'll ferment by the bacteria, the natural stuff in it. And I'm really interested in cranberry and pomegranate mixture, of mixing those two and how it would work.
All right, and you mentioned the alcohol content that might arise out of this, and I think this is part of how they make hooch in prison. But
So Bill, I'll take this one because we each have fermenting caves, and I usually do the alcohol side, and Kirsten did the vegetable side. So the book is almost all vegetables, and so that's lactofermentation, and I think where you're going to go is acetobacter, which is going to – that's the open air. It's going to be attracted to the fruit juices, and you're going to get vinegar out of that eventually. First of all, it's going to go through a process where it's going to get alcoholic, and then it's going to turn into vinegar after that. So there's a lot of benefits of vinegars out there. I certainly think there's a lot of benefits of ciders, but that's not lacto-fermented vegetables, so it's not really part of what we did in the book.
And a lot of interest in the last couple of years in kombucha, which is also a fermented beverage, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just as far as I know, you said something about eating the sugars. Now, lacto-fermentation with the vegetables, it does eat the starches and the sugars of the vegetable. And when you get a vegetable like a tomato that has a high sugar content, you do get that alcohol growing. Interestingly, though, cranberries, if you want to ferment straight fresh cranberries and get that fruit and cranberry thing, cranberries do not have so much sugar that they turn alcoholic, and they do ferment quite nicely with lactic acid.
Okay, so back to vegetables. I mean, what actually is taking place in the fermenting process? The way you describe it, it sounds like with the conversion, it's actually being digested by other creatures before you get to it?
That's actually a way a lot of people like to describe it, is it's pre-digested. It makes it... So the lactic acid starts moving. They like the little saline environment that you create for them, and they get to going. They eat the starches, they eat the sugars, and produce less acid as they go. And that acidic environment is what makes it safe. It's what gives it that flavor.
So it's just sort of a vinegar kind of thing. I mean, you get that sort of level of acid going on.
Yeah, it's sort of like vinegar. It's a different group of bacteria. It's lactic acid instead of acetobacters.
And it seems that we've got, finally gotten to a point in history when we are coming to grips with the idea that some bacteria is actually pretty good for us. You don't have to kill everything to have a successful life. And, in fact, you don't want to. Because we're dealing with the microbiome, and the fact is that we do have good bacteria in our guts and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the fascinating thing of this whole thing is not only are you getting a food that is now rich and alive and it helps your own microbiome stay healthy and repopulate itself in cases where maybe, you know, you've been on antibiotics or whatever, but the food itself is also becoming at the same time more nutrient available. The bacteria is helping your body digest it.
Some terminology to clear up here. Are fermenting and pickling the same thing?
They are indeed. Pickling is acidifying something. That is sort of the official definition. And you are acidifying it by the process. This the same as vinegar pickles. You're acidifying it by adding the vinegar. So the older version of pickling was always fermentation. It was when we figured out somewhere along human history that we could add vinegar and make the process go faster that pickling became also a vinegar process.
I'm sure by now friends have introduced you to the Portlandia episode with the...
absolutely.
Yeah, so we can pickle that. Is it that simple? Can you pickle just about anything?
Just about anything. Not everything tastes so great, but...
Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. They are the operators of the website Fermentista.us and the authors of the book Fermented Vegetables. Applegate Valley Farmers here to answer your questions about fermentation with vegetables. Join us at 800-838-3760. That's anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. How long did it take before you guys felt like you were really good at this? Or does it really take long at all if you just have some basics in mind?
I don't think it takes really long at all. I think it takes, for some people, just seeing it and watching it. It takes just a few experiences. And once you feel like you understand what's going on and you really get that piece of keeping it submerged and you're not scared of the process and you just, you're not scared to throw it away either if it doesn't work.
Usually in our classes, we'll make a jar. Everybody will make a jar right there, and they're on their way. And then depending on how long it takes, it can ferment in a week or less. And usually we hear from people right after that that it tasted it, they were surprised it tasted good, and they're already starting something else.
All right. You mentioned in the book that, and you just mentioned on the air as well, that it's not a sterile process like canning. But you obviously want to keep your hands and your kitchen clean. So once you get past that step, what are some of the first steps then for beginners? Just getting into your first batch of anything. And what would you recommend people start with?
Well, you want to stay clean, but you don't want to use antibacterial soaps or rinse your vegetables in a vegetable rinse. You want some of that bacteria. But, yeah, you want everything nice and clean. You know, there are lots of great vegetables to start with, but cabbage really does work well. I mean, there is a reason that sauerkraut has been so used throughout the centuries. But that said, if you really don't want to start with what you think of as plain sauerkraut, we have a recipe in our book for lemon dill sauerkraut, and that was something that we called the gateway kraut when we were at market, because often people that did not like sauerkraut and they came up, you know, noses wrinkled and were happy to tell us how they didn't like it. If they would try it, they would say, wow, yeah. And all that is it's got a little garlic, a little lemon and dill, and it's enough to, you know, give it some brightness.
But this is the difference then between what we were talking about before, between actual kraut as you make it, you don't always call it sauerkraut, it's just generally kraut for short in the book, and what people have gotten used to over the years from hot dog stands coming out of cans.
Right.
Totally different product.
And if you want a public coming out, the Thanksgiving's in a couple of weeks, you could do something like the cranberries, which is super simple. Just some good cranberries at the co-op and make a brine solution and you're good to go. And then you can bring that instead of the canned jelly thing on the table and start that way.
Let's talk about the brine solution. So obviously the salt, I mean, again, back to the original recipe, vegetables plus salt plus thyme equals yum. How much salt and how do you prepare things generally for a batch of, say, kraut, just a basic cabbage kraut?
So there's I'm going to back up just a tiny bit. There's three kinds of fermentation in the book. One we call dry salting, which is kind of a funny way to say it because it's all about making your brine. And this would be what we would do with an average sauerkraut. The second is brine pickling, which is like a brine pickle. You have a whole vegetable, whether it's a pickle, cucumber, or a piece of cauliflower, or whatever, and you pour a brine solution over the top of that. The last is sort of a hybrid of the two, and that's kimchi, where you actually brine pickle the cabbage overnight and then pull it out of the brine and then put all your spices and vegetables in. So back to the dry salting, that would be most of the fermentation that's done. And with the dry salting, you, like for about a 3.5-pound cabbage, you're going to use about a tablespoon of salt. We always suggest to people put in less salt than you think it's going to be. Mush it around in there, massage it, get that brine worked, and then taste it and make sure it's not too salty. You can always add more, and generally you will have to add the rest of your salt, but it's so much easier to put more salt in than take salt out. And a salty raw ferment going in is not going to get less salty as it ferments.
But the moisture in this process comes just from what's already in the cabbage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where that kind of concept of dry salting comes from. It's the moisture that's in the cabbage that's being drawn out by the salt.
Fermented Vegetables is the topic on the Jefferson Exchange. I have the title of the book by Kirsten Shockey and Christopher Shockey. Let's go to Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, God, that was exactly going to be my question. My old friend used to make sauerkraut with, he'd shred his cabbage, and he'd find an old Sparklets water bottle crock, and put a layer, a little salt, but he used rock salt, like for sidewalks or ice cream, I'm not sure. And then the rest layers of cabbage, and we always put a weight on top, like a saucer that fit just inside with a heavy rock, and every couple of days he would stir it. It was delicious. And also I have a question about, sometimes I read something that says vinegar, and I never know if they mean distilled or apple cider. So if you could address those things.
Okay, so salt and weight and vinegar. Thanks for that, Jeannie. Good to hear from you.
That sounds delicious. That is a time-honored way to make sauerkraut. Vinegar. So we don't recommend adding vinegar at the beginning of the process. If you're going to do lactofermentation, because the acetobacters in the vinegar can hamper the lactic acid bacteria, and you don't want to hamper them doing their good work. Many pickles and different things these days are vinegar based, in which case they aren't lactic acid. Some of the old canning recipes, though, that I found, it must have been during a time where the USDA the extension agents were trying to figure out safer ways. And so a lot of these recipes, you ferment your sauerkraut or your pickles first, and then you rinse it all off, and then you add vinegar, and then you can them, which seems like a lot of work and a little bit ridiculous nowadays. But some of those older recipes, that's what they did. So that might be the vinegar that you've seen.
So you can make your own pickles at home, obviously, without having to go through really tight seals and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. You're just talking about this process, this fermenting process.
Oh, absolutely.
Kinds of salt. She was talking about the rock salt, and there you do deal with that in the book a bit. And there's all kinds of the pink Himalayan salt and everything else, it seems like. So is it just a matter of your own personal taste, or do some salts actually make the process itself work a little better?
I personally think that some salts not necessarily make the process work better, but definitely make your whole ferment not only tastier but healthier. So we really recommend not using processed salts. Things like kosher pickling salt is what everybody grabs first, and it tastes really briny. And the idea of kosher pickle salt is pure, but the pure means it's just a really high sodium chloride content. Rock salt does work, but it's nicer to use a little bit of a finer grade just because it'll break things down a little quicker.
Ethan, no location given. I think he's in the Rogue Valley, wants to know if he did his first batch of sauerkraut this summer. Turned out great, but he's wondering if there's a good local source for better salts. He's read that salts, different salts can make for better results, and he wants the title again. Fermented vegetables. So a good place where you get salt from the Rogue Valley, Applegate Valley?
Both co-ops, the Medford Co-op and the Ashland Co-op, have a number of different salts. In fact, they have a smoke salt, which is really nice. We would tell people, especially women that would come back and they're trying to get their husbands into it, and we'd say, hey, get the smoke salt, because then it's going to smell like a barbecue and you'll hook him that way.
All right. It's the guy salt, I guess.
It's the guy salt.
Sounds good. Kirsten Schocke, Christopher Schocke, the guests on The Exchange. Their book is Fermented Vegetables, Creative Recipes for Fermenting 64 Vegetables and Herbs, and it's a whole list of things they can make them into. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take more phone calls and emails. Back on The Exchange with the Schockes and you and Fermented Vegetables in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our topic is fermented vegetables, and coincidentally, the book we're talking about is also of that title, Fermented Vegetables, Creative Recipes for Fermenting 64 Vegetables and Herbs in Krauts, Kimchi, Brined Pickles, Chutneys, Relishes, and Pastes. The guests and authors, Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke, from their farm in the Applegate Valley. Good to have them here. You can join us on The Exchange as we talk about the process of fermentation with vegetables and how it works and the kinds of great things you can get on the back end. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to get back to the process in just a minute, but how's your health been since you changed to fermented foods, and how big a part of your diet is fermented foods?
Well, I think we're pretty healthy.
You look pretty good. Say that much.
Yeah.
Our 18-year-old does complain that most people have refrigerators that have something besides condiments in them and fermented condiments. We have so many varieties sort of on hand regularly that whether people actually take them with their meal, but they are out every meal.
Yeah. And you do get hooked on it. I was on a trip to Little Rock, Arkansas for 5 days, and I came home and I had to hit the kraut and the brine right away. It was a little sparse out there in Little Rock. So
yeah, if your third trip to Waffle House, you come up with something else. Speaking of which, you were talking about using these as condiments, and there's a breakfast section in here about let's talk about breakfast and fermented items and what you guys put on your breakfast. Let's hear a little bit about that, just so people get an idea of the variety of where you can use fermented foods.
Sure. I'll start with the crazy one. So we had a lady that came, a little, I think, Japanese lady that used to come to the farmer's market, and she would buy kimchi. And one day I asked her, you know, how she likes to eat it, expecting to hear something. And she said, on oatmeal, just matter-of-factly, on my oatmeal. And I thought that was the craziest thing I'd ever heard. And so, but we eventually got to the point where we were doing homemade feta cheese and homemade brined olives and kimchi, and it's actually really good on oatmeal. So that's the most odd one, I would say.
Yeah, omelets, I mean, mm-hmm. A lot of the various krauts, the lemon dill that I mentioned, Credito, which is a El Salvadorian inspired recipe, all of those, and the pepper pastes and the salsas go wonderfully on eggs and omelets.
You can throw them on a schmear and they're great on a bagel. Just throw those. Good flavor for a cream cheese. Kind of zip it up.
All right. So any meal. Fermentation. Not just for dinner anymore.
Even breakfast.
Even breakfast. We talked about salts. We talked about dry salt, brine pickling, and kimchi, which is a combination of the other two types. In general, what's the longest amount of time you're going to have anything fermenting before it's ready to eat?
Well, you know, it's a very fuzzy, it depends kind of answer.
And careful, I think the use of the word fuzzy. We're talking
about that's true.
Another metaphor. it can be on how big of the crock is. Mm-hmm. So let's go big 10-gallon crock and really a cool environment, maybe 60 degrees. You know, we could go up to almost a month sometimes on those, right, fermenting.
Right, and some things you really want that long ferment. Pepper pastes, for example, which is just hot peppers and salt. The flavors really get complex and develop over time. It's good to eat in, you know, maybe 3 weeks, but if you let it go for 3 months, 6 months, I know that Tabasco sauce, I think, is aged for something like 3 years. And so it really is, and it depends. It depends on your flavor. We tell people in our classes and in the book, taste it as you're making this process. Some people really like a half sour pickle. They might like a half sour kraut.
So you can arrest the process at some point. You just sort of stop the fermentation from taking place. And then what are you going to do? You're going to put it in individual containers and store it in the fridge?
Exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't die. It is going very slowly in the refrigerator still. And actually, if you decide, wow, you know, I'd like it to be more sour, you can take it back out, warm it up, and those little guys will get back to work.
All right. The book, again, Fermented Vegetables. Our guests, Kirsten Schocke and Christopher Schocke. An email here from Ray. He says, I've been making my own sauerkraut for more than a year now. Love it with a little caraway and mustard seeds tossed in. Also love making my own fermented pickles. Spicy garlic dills are superb. Just don't forget to toss in some grape leaves for their tannin to get that nice crunch. Can't wait to get your book. We'll love expanding my fermenting efforts to include more foods. Thanks, from Ray again. And I noticed a nod from you, Christopher, about the grape leaves.
Yeah, Ray's dropping a great hint. Those tannins will crisp up the pickles. So that's one. And we do those. Pick some of your grape leaves in the fall and store them away, and then you can use them. And he's putting them on top and then putting the weight on top of that. And pickles are a great example where we did a lot of canning and drying and on the farm. But, you know, we had a little card, sometimes just to pick a fight with canning people, and we said, canning makes your pickle limp. And it was to start the conversation, but it was also there are vegetables that are so much better eaten like this than there are canned. You know, the pressure canner, anything that you put in a pressure canner, you're just kissing goodbye in terms of flavor, in my perspective. So. Pickles are one of those.
I want to go back to leaves for just a minute. Sure. Christopher said, tuck them away. What he should have said is if you do want to save grape leaves for, say, doing asparagus pickles in the spring when the grape leaves aren't out yet, grape leaves ferment well. You can roll them in a little bundle, put them in your crock or jar, put your brine over them, and they will ferment, and you will have preserved grape leaves.
What happens to this stuff if you're not careful that does end up poking up out of the brine? You're making it's a great face, Kirsten.
Fuzz.
That is the fuzzy stuff. Okay.
We have in the back of the book the scum gallery. Yeah, and it's one of the few places where some of our photos actually made it, unfortunately. So there's stuff on there. One looks like a lunar. You can imagine a little tiny Neil Armstrong jumping across there. It looks like the surface of the moon. So over the years, when we would come across something, we'd take pictures of it and document it and figure it out, because we wanted people to know these are all the things that could happen. Some of them are good, some of them aren't so good. And so people can look it up and see exactly when they see fur, is that good or bad?
That tends to be bad, doesn't it?
It does tend.
Okay. There is one recipe, I forget which one, but it was like, it was a step to scoop off the mold. Mm-hmm. So their mold will form on some of this stuff, and you just need to scoop it off?
Yeah, sometimes mold will form. It depends. Some people, if they're doing a really quick, small batch, they likely will never see mold, but especially on some of these longer aging times, a little vegetable shred or something will get up above the brine, and some mold will start. Just scoop it off. Everything under the brine, everything anaerobic is safe.
You mentioned some bubbly mixtures here. I mean, is the process ever particularly noisy? I mean, if you come downstairs in the middle of the night, can you hear things going burble, burble?
You can. We heard a cute story of a potter who makes crocks, and she had a bunch going, and her husband came downstairs looking for a leak in the plumbing, and she let him look most of the night, and it was these crocks slowly bloop, 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 but it sounded just like a drip.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fun. You mentioned fermenting caves at the outset, Christopher. What is that?
We just built – you want an ideal temperatures around in the 60s, low 60s degrees. So we built two caves into the hillside of our fermenting room on the farm. And so it's his and hers. And I do my ciders. I just did a 5-gallon bunch of cider on my side, and Kirsten does a lot of the fermented vegetables on her side. But it's just a nice place to age things, cheeses or vegetables.
And that's just because, you know, we're so into food. But anybody can do this on their counter. We don't recommend a fermenting cave.
<All right.
laughs> No. In fact, we do tell people, do it on your counter so you can watch it.
Yeah.
Oh, so you can keep an eye on things.
Yeah,
I think that's where, you know, things go wrong. If you don't really know the process and you tuck it away in a corner and the CO2 pushes out all your brine and you don't see that happen, you go back in a few days later, weeks later, and you didn't see it happen, and you've got a disaster and then frustration. But if you're doing it on your kitchen counter, you can watch it. It's kind of like a chia pet. You know, you can baby it.
Watch it grow day by day. Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's great for kids, too. It's a real science experiment. They can see what's going on. You can explain the CO2 and everything.
Given the discussion of gases here, and given that we're talking about cabbage in particular, this brings up the obvious question about if your own personal experiences with odors tends to be somewhat heightened if you eat more fermented foods.
We just got this question in Medford at the class of 40 people, and I said, I would never admit in a class of 40 people whether we... So I can't imagine on air.
I think the more serious answer is that for a lot of people, if their gut biome is more healthy, you know, they're going to have less of that.
Ah,
but,
okay. It all depends on the starting point.
If you're,
So if you're a person who tends to play a few tunes now and then, you're not going to notice any fewer of them, certainly.
I think you will.
Really?
I think playing tunes is a sign of maybe a gut biome that's, you know, maybe a little bit off kilter one way or another. I'd say down a few jars and report back.
Okay, the musical fruit experiment. Let's take another call. We have Dave in Fortuna with an experiment I thought somebody, or a question I thought somebody would come in with. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kirsten and Christopher Shockey.
Yes, hello. Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question regarding canning for, like, putting food away, for storing it for, I don't know, a disaster time, whatever, how long that you can leave it after you know, get everything set up. What's the longevity of it?
So in other words, if you've been fermenting stuff, how long it'll last? Okay.
Right, exactly.
The process keeps going, so the cooler you can keep it, the better. That's why traditionally in Korea they buried it underground, because you're getting that 55-degree or permafrost ground level. Here we don't really have that. So the cooler you can keep it, and then the anaerobic. So when we keep things for long-term storage outside of the refrigerator, we will usually use a crock that has an airlock or some way that it's allowed to breathe and nothing can get in it. But the cooler, the better. At higher temperatures, you know, might have 6 months. At really cool temperatures, you might have a year or more.
I thought he was going to ask a question actually about preserving meat, and I know I was reading a fermenting piece in the New Yorker probably 2 years ago about high meat, which sounded like something not for the faint of heart. Is this something you guys have ever experimented with?
No.
Judging by the look on your face, Christopher, you never
actually, Kirsten's gotten me to eat all kinds of things, so it probably will happen sometime, but that was the beauty of just writing a book of vegetables. And it was great because raw food people would come up and they could eat it, and gluten-free people could come up and they could eat it, and vegans could come up and they could eat it. So it was nice being in a book where you really didn't upset anybody, and it crossed all those lines.
Ultimately, the book gets into an alphabetical guide to vegetable fermenting. Is there anything that really does not take well to fermenting? I mean, it sounds like you've gone through the whole week and pickle that experience.
Yeah, you know, There are a few surprises. There were some surprises both directions for us on things we really didn't think would pickle well, and they're delicious. Spinach, for example. Kale, you would think it would work well. Collards work well. It's in the cabbage family. We've done it 6 ways to Sunday, and we still haven't found a way that it's tasty. And broccoli also, not so much. Too sulfuric.
Really? Okay. So, and what are some of the things that really did turn out well?
Spinach, for one. I mean, that we just imagined overcooked sludge, but it was actually the salt. Part of what it does is it hardens the pectins, so it actually stayed crispy, which, you know, even though we knew the process, our heads kept telling us something else would happen. And eggplant.
Mm-hmm.
Squash. It's another surprise. Squash is delicious.
Eggplant was it good then?
Eggplant was good. It took me a long time to actually eat it after we'd made it. I just kept looking at it thinking, I have a fragile relationship with eggplant anyway. Uh-huh. I mean, I like eggplant parmesan when it's done just right, but I just kept thinking, And then one day I finally pulled it back out of the refrigerator and said, okay, we got to do this. And I was so pleasantly shocked.
We've already alluded to the odors, more than alluded to them. We just said it out loud a couple of times. But some of the sights then, I mean, was that part of what was repelling you with the eggplant? Was that it just didn't look particularly good?
Yeah, it wasn't a particularly appealing color. It wasn't bad. It was kind of gray. I guess that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't look slimy, but I think, again, I imagined sort of squishy.
All right, so just some basic bits of equipment that people might want to have in hand in the kitchen. I mean, can you pretty much do it with what you have? I mean, if you got, mm-hmm. Is it good to use crockery rather than, for example, metal bowls or plastic bowls or anything for fermenting?
Anything really that you've got in the kitchen is fine. A jar and a Ziploc bag, you're good to go. Crocks are better, but you don't have to have it.
Yeah. All right. The book is called Fermented Vegetables, and it's a whole bunch of recipes from Kirsten and Christopher Shockey, who are the people behind Fermentista.us. You can find lots of information on the website, too. The formula, again, vegetables plus salt plus time equals yum. I want to thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
That'll do it for today's exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Megan Mercier spent some time on the board today as well. She's our student assistant. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We'll talk to you again soon on another edition of the Jefferson Exchange. Have a great day.